Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldet. Coming up, Robin Fisher talks with Middle East expert Anthony Sullivan. First, both Democratic presidential candidates have offered their opinions on one of Kentucky's abundant resources, coal. Both champion clean coal, but as WFPL's Kristen Espelon reports, there may not be much to champion yet.
I am going to make sure that we've got a clean energy economy.
And the best way to create good jobs is through clean, renewable energy.
Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton spoke in Kentucky and Indiana this month, rallying crowds before Tuesday's primary election. Each candidate told supporters that developing clean and renewable energy sources would top their to-do list in the White House. Both candidates have expressed a desire to invest in one such source, clean coal. But what exactly is clean coal?
It really refers to a suite of technologies.
This is Tom Sarkis with the National Energy Technology Laboratory.
Anything from emissions control to new power generation technologies such as IGCC or integrated gasification combined cycle.
In an IGCC plant, coal isn't burned. Rather, it's exposed to heat, steam, and pressure to set off a chemical reaction. The results of that reaction are something called syngas. The syngas then powers turbines to generate electricity, and the byproduct heat is captured and used to start the whole process over again. There are only two IGCC plants operating in the U.S. now. Tom Sarkis says they put out about a tenth of the pollution a regular coal plant does, but utilities aren't exactly jumping on the IGCC bandwagon.
It can cost 10 to 20% more than a conventional coal-fired power plant.
IGCC may be a promising clean technology for new plants, but it doesn't solve the remaining problems with coal-fired plants. Many utilities have managed to reduce the acid rain causing emissions by adding devices called scrubbers. They've managed to reduce the tiny particulate matter that comes spewing out of stacks. But Sarkis says the next challenges include dealing with mercury emissions.
And the next one that's looming on the horizon is carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas contributing to global warming, and coal-fired power plants put out a lot of CO2. Both Democratic presidential candidates want to reduce carbon emissions to 80% of what they were in 1990. Both want to develop clean coal. Both say they would invest $150 billion over a decade in renewable energy. Obama's campaign did not return repeated phone calls, but his website says he'll support clean coal as well as consider banning new traditional coal plants. Clinton's senior energy advisor, Dan Utek, gets specific about how she would spend that renewable energy money to deal with carbon emissions.
One of the purposes of that money would be to fund 10 large-scale projects to test this capture and storage technology.
Coal plants aren't required to capture and store carbon, but many researchers, politicians, and industry representatives believe it's only a matter of time in a new presidential administration before they are. E.ON U.S. Executive Paul Thompson believes carbon legislation is a strong possibility. Thompson says his own utility is investing in dozens of projects worldwide to figure out ways to contain or store carbon. But he says those technologies aren't ready for use on a commercial scale.
The storage of carbon dioxide underground, which is thought to be the most likely good answer for us, it is very feasible. But our industry is a large-scale industry, and that's what we need to prove out.
In other words, the technologies are still in research and development. Meanwhile, there's no sign we'll be reducing our coal consumption anytime soon. Rather, we'll be waiting to see how a new president approaches this resource that's abundant, but imperfect. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espelon.
A waning economy, the war in Iraq, and health care have been big issues in this year's presidential primary campaigns. Policies on the arts also have made their way into some candidates' platforms. This development is part of a concerted national effort, as WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer reports.
Back in the fall of 2006, when presidential contenders began holding talks with groups in New Hampshire, some arts advocates showed up regularly. Representatives from the New Hampshire Citizens for the Arts and the federal organization Americans for the Arts asked candidates about their views on arts education, on support for the National Endowment for the Arts, and on the potential role for the arts in diplomatic cultural exchanges. Narek Rome works for Americans for the Arts.
This was the first time that a coordinated effort to address the arts in a national campaign had been attempted, and getting involved real early on the ground in early primary estate has really been beneficial to the strategy.
The question sparked responses that came in later speeches and sound bites. In January 2007, on NBC's Meet the Press, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee touted the arts in education and in a creative economy. In stump speeches, he and most of the Democratic candidates talked about the arts. Now, more than a year later, both Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have specific promises to support the arts posted on their web pages. While Senator John McCain has not specified any art policies, Senator Clinton proposes a $200 million increase in the NEA budget. Senator Obama took up the subject at a rally last month in Pennsylvania.
The endowment for the arts, our support of the public arts, our support for arts institutions, all those things should be a priority, and they don't cost that much money.
In recent years, Americans for the Arts has beefed up its efforts to promote the arts by building a nationwide network of advocates and working more closely with affiliated state organizations like Arts Kentucky. Both groups send out emails about arts legislation and provide voting records on their websites. Through the internet and at events, they make the case for the arts. Again, Narek Rome.
The arts are one segment of our national public policy spectrum, but the research that we have in a growing way shows that the arts are a core element to local economic development plans.
Americans for the Arts has conducted several studies on local economies. A January 2006 study counted 22,000 employees in arts-related businesses in Kentucky. Last year, a study on Louisville reported that the area's arts and culture groups generated nearly $23 million in local and state revenue. Arts Kentucky has been using that information to make its case. David Cupps is Arts Kentucky's executive director. He says having candidates talk about the arts will definitely help persuade more people about the importance of public support, but he doesn't expect it to make that much of a difference with most individual voters.
I don't expect people to be single-issue voters and that this is going to be the thing that they make their decision on, but I think this is one piece of the pie. And for the people that it's their livelihood, it might move them quite a bit.
Louisville sculptor Brad White is one such voter. He says he knows that other issues seem more crucial these days, but believes that more recognition and funding is overdue. He says the recent discussions by candidates can bring about change.
If someone of that stature is talking about it and raising awareness of it, then other people are going to get behind it and think it's important. I mean, they do that with negative issues all the time.
For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
One topic at the forefront of the presidential debate is the war in Iraq and policies regarding the Middle East. But how much do we really know about this area of the world? Anthony Sullivan, president of the consulting firm Near East Support Services and an associate at the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Michigan, was in town recently and he sat down with Robin Fisher to talk about the Middle East, our misconceptions of the area, and what the future holds.
Now, we hear a lot about the Middle East. I mean, daily it's in the news. But could you take a moment and geographically define the area for us?
Well, you know, that's interesting that you should ask that question off the top, because there have been many different definitions of what the Middle East is. And the Middle East, in fact, definitions thereof have changed over time. For example, is North Africa part of the Middle East? There's a good reason for making an argument that it is. But I think there are stronger arguments for saying that countries like Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia are not. The center of what has historically been known as the Middle East would stretch from Egypt through Palestine, today Israel, Lebanon, Syria, eastward through Iraq, and many would also include Iran. Saudi Arabia has its own particular history. Certainly most definitions of the Middle East today would include Saudi Arabia and the Arab Gulf states just to the west of what is called, depending on whom you're speaking to, either the Arab Gulf or the Persian Gulf, the Persian Gulf being the traditional term. And since the fall of the Soviet Union, the Islamic republics of the former unlamented USSR are now perhaps in some tenuous sense parts of a greater Middle East. And the Middle East, of course, having said that much, has to be separated from the much larger Islamic world, which, of course, in fact, girdles the world today. We have, many people don't realize this, we have 6 million, and that's a conservative figure, Muslims in the United States today. And in fact, there are about, and the census data is not perfect. There's some doubt about the data, but let's just say there's about 500,000 more Muslims in the United States today than there are Jews. But of course, many of the Muslims coming from the Middle East, as I've defined it here, but many of them from South Asia, from Indonesia, from Pakistan, from India, are certainly no connection with the Middle East as it's normally defined. But we have 1.4 billion Muslims out there, and Arabs living in the Middle East are only 20% of that total. And that's an important thing for people to keep in mind.
Well, I actually had read that statistic, mm-hmm. that it's only 20%. So how diverse is the area, ethnically and religiously?
It's enormously diverse. And we see some of that diversity, of course, has been in the news recently, playing out with the 18 different communal groups in Lebanon, to take an obvious example. Many of them diametrically opposed to each other. I was speaking about some of that at the Louisville Committee for Foreign Relations. Just an obvious example, you have the group Hezbollah, which is aligned, of course, in Lebanon. These are Lebanese operatives when we talk about Hezbollah. They are Shia. They're allied with Iran and with Syria. But we also have, of course, the Sunni Lebanese, who are now considerably less in Lebanon as a proportion of the Lebanese population than they once were. Shiites are increasing rapidly, but the Sunnis rely for support today on France, on the United States, and on Saudi Arabia. The Shia rely for support on Syria, and most fundamentally, Iran. Now, having said that, keep in mind that in the Middle East, however defined, there are very significant Christian groups. And these, as oftentimes is totally forgotten, who are these Christians? They are Arabs. However, sometimes they define themselves, for example, Maronites in Lebanon, who oftentimes speak French better than Arabic, and have historically identified with France, sometimes call themselves not Arabs, but Phoenicians, which mixes up all sorts of historical data. But in any event, you have Melkites, you have Chaldeans, you have Maronites, you have Roman Catholics, you have Greek Orthodox in various iterations, such as Armenian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, you have Anglicans. So the Middle East, above all, is not homogeneous. That's so important for people to understand. The Middle East, however defined, is far less homogeneous than the United States. And both among Christians and among Muslims, the differences are enormous. The communities, both of those communities, are divided in all sorts of complicated ways within themselves. So anyone who speaks about, quote, Islam or Muslims as basically, supposedly all one thing is simply talking nonsense.
Well, you know, I find that interesting, and I think it's something that we here in the States have a problem maybe grasping mentally, because we are a melting pot. And by and large, we all get along, we come together, we hold our elections. You know, you might not care for one group or another, but then you go somewhere, you look at the Middle East and you look at how fractious it is, and you know, you've got different types of Muslims and different types of Christians and different types of Jews. And I think, you know, sometimes I think the American in us wants to say, why can't they just all get along?
Yes, and that is a tremendous tendency. You're absolutely right. And it's very American, by the way. Our country has historically been what? It's been a melting pot. People come here from all over the world, but they become something recognizably different, which is they become Americans. Now, that is not the case, as we know, in much of Western Europe, France being the best example of that. America has a capacity to assimilate in a way which no European country has demonstrated, including the UK, that they have a capability of doing. Now, our country is based on assimilation, traditionally has been. It's worked, at least up until very recently, very, very well. The Middle East is not based on that notion at all. The Middle East is based on tribalism, taking a longer point of view, and communitarianism within these multifarious and different communities that I've been talking about here. In other words, for a better Middle East, there has to be a recognition that each group in the Middle East should be permitted not to assimilate to anything. They should be permitted, whether Jews, Christians, or Muslims, to remain themselves. Everything in the Middle East is represented by a balance of groups, communities, sects, if you want. Sometimes they're defined as tribes, Iraq being a good example of that. Other times, Lebanon being the best example, they're defined as being particular, different religious communities. So the structure of the Middle East and the history of the Middle East is radically different from the history of the United States. And one of the reasons I think why it's so difficult for Americans to understand the Middle East is that the realities for the functioning of society in the Middle East are so radically different from what most Americans are used to and what they understandably believe are the realities of social life and accurately understand in the United States.
Who are the major political powers, and then who wants to be on top?
Well, you opened the can of worms there. I'll give you the short one. I could lecture on this for 6 hours, but I will eschew that temptation. The most dynamic power in the Middle East right now, for good or for ill, is Iran. Iran has been very much in the news recently. Iran is the great victor from the war in Iraq. As I recall, President Bush did not have that particularly in mind when he made his ill-fated and highly inadvisable move into Iraq. And future historians may look with some mordant humor at all of the rhetoric that we've heard for so many years about making Iraq democratic, free, or translated, really, just like us. And that, Robin, is not going to happen, no matter how many billions of dollars continue to be spent. So Iran is a major player. Iran has its allies. Syria, of course, being one. Hezbollah, in particular, being another. Keep in mind always, and Americans, I won't give the lecture this afternoon, but Americans need to know the difference between a Sunni Muslim and a Shia Muslim. And I can assure you that the U.S. Congress that makes or contributes to the formulation, supposedly at least, of U.S. foreign policy, the members admit, at least up until recently, they did not have a clue as to what the difference fundamental. We went into Iraq without any understanding of this is between a Sunni and a Shia. Very a grossly simplistic category is that, let's say, the Islamic world in the Sunni-Shia sense is somewhere where Western Europe was perhaps in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, during the wars of religion between Protestantism and all of its emanations and Roman Catholicism. That time, the bodies were piled very high and very deep. And we're seeing something that could simplistically perhaps be compared to that in the Islamic world today. And this is a long historical process that has led to where we are now. And Jeremiads or urgings from the White House, Jeremiads to Americans, urging of people in the Middle East to be just like us and embrace what's really meant Western-style secular democracy and liberty is not going to cut it.
In the midst of all of this, you have Israel.
Indeed.
Which is the lightning rod for the region.
Indeed.
What's the answer?
That's a very American question. Again, so I'll give you a very brief and totally unsatisfactory answer by saying that there is no answer. If I were an Israeli today with any kind of vision at all, I would be very, very worried. The Atlantic, and I recommend it was a very recent issue, either the previous issue or maybe still the current issue. The Atlantic magazine has an article by a distinguished American Jew in it. And the title of the article, which the Atlantic put on the front cover of the magazine, is Israel finished? ? That gets your attention.
Definitely.
And he went through, it's a very nuanced, very serious article. And the answer to that question, I'm afraid, is yes, in some fundamental sense. If we're talking about 50 years, for example, or possibly much less time than that. Because no matter what Israel does, if it again engages in what we call ethnic cleansing, which it's done on numerous periods in the past, fact of the matter, going back to 1948, of Palestinians, Arabs, however you want to designate them, between the Jordan River and the sea, in an attempt to solve its demographic problem, the Arabs in it, however you define Israel, that doesn't solve its demographic problem. Even if it drives Arabs and Palestinians into Jordan, more of them, and elsewhere, because Israel is fated to be in a Middle East that is overwhelmingly non-Jewish, and with every, tragically, every day almost that passes, the hatred of Israel because of its policies that many Americans are not aware of, and of the United States, which all polling data indicates, gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And therefore, one of the challenges, I think, for Americans is to understand that although we do and should support Israel, a question that needs to be asked in our own national interest, and that's what Americans should be concerned with, is, let me suggest, what Israel should we support? Under what conditions should we support that Israel? And specifically, within what boundaries? What the United States has been doing since 1967 has been supporting a greater Israel, which has been moving forward just like the French did in Algeria. That's the fact of the matter, in creating, as Israelis themselves describe them, facts on the ground in Palestinian Arab territory. I'm talking here specifically about what we call the West Bank. Yes, there have been all sorts of violent Arabs, Hamas, we all know about, but the challenge for us as Americans, as I think, as far as Israel goes, today more than ever, is to move under energetic presidential leadership, which we certainly haven't had during the last 8 years. Bill Clinton, and I did not vote for Bill Clinton, but Bill Clinton made a really major attempt to bring the actors together. But that's another story. The present president has not made any such attempt. But in our own national interest, we have to push for Israelis and Palestinians to, if we have to repartition the land between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. And that's possible. If Israelis want to keep parts of the West Bank, then they are going to have to give up parts, compensating parts, of what is today Israel within what used to be called the Green Line. For example, sections of the Galilee. There has to be an exchange of territory. And until we as Americans begin to talk truth to power here in this country, the Middle East crisis and the Israeli-Palestinian crisis will go on and on and on and constantly worsen.
If there's one thing that you would hope that average Americans would know about the Middle East, what would that be?
Find out, educate yourself in the realities of the history of certainly the Israeli-Palestinian problem in the last 60 years. And above all, I would recommend to every American who can do it, and there are groups that will take you to the region. Go to the region. Don't go with any self-interested group. that is connected with any political party or particular movement, go with as objective a group as you can find. And there are many people who can make recommendations on that score. Go and talk to as many people and as many groups and as many different points of view and their multitudinous as you possibly can. What happens when most Americans do that, when they go to the Middle East, the scales fall so dramatically from their eyes, and they say to themselves, how come I never knew any of this? And I know that's true because when I was 22, that was several years ago, and I first went to the Middle East with my wife, that was exactly my reaction. That was a long time ago. But we know and we understand the Israelis, and that's wonderful. But we have never understood the other, as so many people call it, the Arab and Islamic world. It is essential in our own national interest that we begin to correct that gross misunderstanding. And one of the things that concerns me today, above all, is that so many of our bien pensant, of our intellectual leaders, are tragically sharing from us information which I must call disinformation about the realities in the Arab and Islamic world. We need to correct that, and I hope we will be able to begin to do that very soon.
That was Robin Fisher talking with Anthony T. Sullivan, president of the consulting firm Near East Support Services and an associate at the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Michigan, talking about the Middle East. Dr. Sullivan was in town for a public lecture sponsored by the Louisville Committee on Foreign Relations. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Gabe Bullard learns more about youth services disparities in southern Indiana. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up, I'll speak with author Elizabeth George. First, last year, the Indiana General Assembly voted to create the Commission on Disproportionality in Youth Services. On June 11th, the panel will hold a public forum in New Albany to address inequalities in services such as adoption, welfare, and education. Gabe Bullard talked with Commission co-chairs Angela Green and Michael Petchner about the new group.
Tell me a little bit about the program, first off.
The Commission on Disproportionality in Youth Services has been legislated from 2007 legislative session to provide research and information and recommendations, if you will, on disproportionate numbers in youth services in Indiana, looking at four particular service areas, and that is education, child welfare, juvenile justice, and mental health services. And our purpose is to bring forth recommendations that will reduce the disproportionality that we are seeing in youth services in Indiana.
What kind of disproportionality are you seeing?
And when we talk about disproportionality, we're really looking at an overrepresentation or even an underrepresentation. We're talking about youth of color, particularly here. So you're talking about African-American, Hispanic, Asian-Pacific, and so forth. And we're looking at their representation within those four service areas. And we're looking at disparity as well in the service provision to those particular individuals, as well as disproportionate numbers and rates. If there are more African-American children than we find in a particular system, then their general population percentage, and that will be considered overrepresentation. If we see they're not being, they're not able to utilize maybe diversion programs, for example, then we may see there's an underrepresentation of those in that particular system.
And what are you finding?
Right now we're looking at the data and getting public input. One thing that has been critical is hearing some of the stories from individuals who are utilizing those services. So we have actually a public forum that will be in New Albany, Indiana, on June the 11th. It will actually be at Indiana University Southeast there in Floyd County from 6:30 to 8:30. We really hope people will come out so that we hear their stories and what are their experiences within these four service areas of child welfare, education, juvenile justice, as well as mental health services.
What kind of numbers or data are you finding? The statistic I found says black people comprise only 8% of the state's child population, but make up 37% of those waiting to be adopted and 28% of those cared for outside of their homes.
Yes, so those are correct findings that we have. And that's one of the reasons why the commission was created, Gabe, because there are disproportionate numbers of minorities in service areas.
Have you found out perhaps why?
And that's actually what we're looking at. We're looking at each point of the system in the four areas and then seeing if there are some spikes or peaks in those areas and try to really guesstimate and use our public to help us look at those numbers and see the reason why and get some possible recommendations to reduce those numbers. One thing that we recognize, I mean, it is a national problem, but in Indiana, we're not satisfied with just being a national problem. We want to really address this. And this is the state's first time of really taking a good look at this. So we're really in the beginning stages of looking at the numbers and recognizing we have to drill down even more with the data to maybe even begin to answer some of those questions. However, we want to know what programs in the state are occurring that may be able to assist with this, what might need to be enhanced, what's missing in our service areas. We're looking at that. We're looking at the funding streams as well. Where should dollars be devoted to help curb this? And also, is the training that is occurring in across the state, is that adequate in addressing cultural competence and addressing racial inequities? Are we actually hitting this? So those are some of our charges. And recognizing that, we do have some experts at the table, but this is an area that we really are exploring, I would say, at this level for the first time in the state. And I commend our governor and our legislature for recognizing this problem and putting the funding as well as the commission together to help really provide some guidance.
That was Gabe Bullard talking with the co-chairs of the Indiana Commission on Disproportionality in Youth Services. Another episode in the life of Inspector Lindley is on the bookshelves. The fictional Scotland Yard Detective Superintendent Thomas Lindley is working another case in a new novel, Careless in Red. Lindley's creator is best-selling mystery writer Elizabeth George, who spoke with us about the new work, including a shocking turn of events in Lindley's personal life. As for those who don't know, including me, let's get a little history lesson on Detective Lindley. When did you create him? How long has he been around?
Lindley has been around for 20 years, and this year is exactly his 20th anniversary. As a matter of fact, the novel that's coming out, Careless in Red, is being published almost to the day, 20 years after the very first Lindley novel came out, and that was a book called The Great Deliverance.
Now, I understand he's been going through some tough times in his personal life.
He has indeed. A couple of books prior to Careless in Red, Lindley's wife was killed. She was murdered in one of these senseless street killings that occur with disturbing frequency in London now. And this is something that Lindley has been recovering from. This book, Careless in Red, brings him back to police work in a way. And it reintroduces him to the world after spending some time really recovering from his wife's death.
How did your readers react to his wife's death?
Well, you know, the readers reacted pretty much the way Lindley reacted, which is what I wanted to happen. When a continuing character is killed in this way in a book, the last thing that the writer wants is for the reader to finish the novel, set it down, and go to the refrigerator for a beer or a bologna sandwich. What the writer really wants is for the reader to face that same kind of sense of moral outrage and grief that the character is experiencing, and that's pretty much what happened.
Now, many of your novels have been filmed by the BBC, and we see them here on PBS. What's it like to see that, your novels turned into film?
It's really great fun, to tell you the truth. The books, of course, never are translated directly, because when you're working with the novel and when you're working with film, you're working in two entirely different kinds of formats. And so a lot of material has to be left by the wayside when something's put into film. But, you know, having said that, I was pretty much gratified to see the performances of the main characters, both Nathaniel Parker as Linley and Sharon Small as Havers. You know, while they don't look anything like the characters in the books, they really captured the essence of the characters on film. I was real pleased with that.
Are there any plans for this book to be filmed?
Not at the moment, no. No, I certainly would hope so. I would hope that eventually there would be interest in that. But right now, I don't know about that.
Now, are all your books set in the UK?
Yes, every single book has been set in the UK. They're all set in different areas. Even when the book takes place in London, it would be in a section of London that previous books have not been set in. Most of them, however, have gone out into different areas of the countryside.
Now, your book's just coming out. Are you working on something else now?
I am. Whereas Careless and Red takes place in Cornwall, and that's the book coming out this week, the book that I'm working on right now takes place both in London and in an area of Hampshire called the New Forest.
I see. Any particular reason why you chose, obviously you're an American, why you chose the UK as a setting for your books?
You know, I've had a long time interest in the UK. This began when I was in high school, and I was in high school in the 60s, and this was a period of time when everything that informed our pop culture came from Great Britain. This was the pop music, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Dave Clark Five. I mean, all of those people came over from England at that period of time, and we had fashion from Mary Quant being modeled by Twiggy. We had motion pictures that were coming over from England. So that was really what began my interest in Great Britain, and it just continued ever since then.
Who were some of your literary influences as you were growing up?
I think my most profound literary influence was probably the British novelist John Fowles, who wrote The French Lieutenant's Woman. That's probably his most famous book. And the Collector and a number of other novels. You know, what I loved about John Fowles, aside from his style, which is so magnificent, was the fact that he always took risks in his writing. He never wrote the same book twice. Some things worked, some things didn't work, but he was always pushing the envelope of what constitutes the novel, and I'm a great admirer of him as a result of that.
Well, the name of the book is Careless in Red, and Elizabeth George is the author. Ms. George, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
There's more information at our website, WFPL.org. The author of The Devil Wears Prada has a new book. She'll talk with Robin Fisher when we come back. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldet. Single young women trying to find the perfect man and the perfect job in New York City. Does that sound familiar? That's not what you think. Instead, it's the latest novel by Lauren Weisberger, author of The Devil Wears Prada. Robin Fisher spoke with Weisberger about love, friendship, and life in the big city in her new book, Chasing Harry Winston, a novel.
Tell us a little bit about Lee, Emmy, and Adriana.
The three girls met in college, and they have been best friends ever since. And the book sort of opens with Emmy finding out that her boyfriend of 5 years, who she had pegged as her future husband, actually is leaving her for the trainer at the gym that she pays for, and she bought him the trainer as a birthday present. And it's sort of this nightmare that leads Emmy and the girls to sit down over dinner and make a pact that in 1 year they're going to drastically change their lives. Emmy, who has been a serial monogamist, is going to become a whole lot more promiscuous, and she pledges that she's going to start brazenly sleeping around. And Adriana, who is the gorgeous, fabulous, very glamorous Brazilian who has had no trouble with men her whole life, has decided that it's time to settle down, and she's going to find herself a husband. In 12 months, she's going to have a ring on her finger. And Lee, the third one, who is a bit more even than Emmy and Adriana, she seems to have the perfect job and the perfect boyfriend and the perfect apartment. Can't really think of anything she wants to change, but of course we find out as the book goes on that her life is kind of the biggest disaster of all.
Each of the women actually throughout the book changes, as we mentioned, mm-hmm. But Lee and Emmy especially are just as concerned about their careers as their love lives. And I wondered, do you think this is typical of women of that age group today?
Oh, I definitely do. I think it's that constant struggle to maintain that balance in your life. You know, you have the three, at least for me and my friends, we're always talking about there's these three aspects, overall aspects of your life, your romantic life and your social life and your professional life. And you're always working really hard to change one of them and get it up to shape. And as soon as you do, the other two fall apart. So, you know, I really wanted to kind of strike that chord of reality and have these girls dealing with all the different areas of their lives, because I do think that today that's what women are thinking about.
There's an interesting exchange in the book between Lee and the author that she's working with, Jesse, about chick lit.
Yes, I couldn't resist.
I thought that was very interesting. Do you think that chick lit gets a bad rap?
It does sometimes. You know, people kind of like to write it off as just pure entertainment, and I'm not totally sure why that's the worst thing in the world. I think anything that gets people to pick up a book and helps them relax and makes them laugh and keeps them entertained and keeps them coming back for more is pretty great. So,
and you know, I want to stay on this for just a second, because unbeknownst to our listeners right now, Lee is a book editor, and she is editing a literary giant.
Yes.
But for pleasure, that she reads chick lit. And you mentioned some real books in there, not just books that you've made up.
Yes, absolutely. So it just seemed fitting to me, because I think that is also something that's pretty realistic. Just because she has a literary sensibility at work and is editing all sorts of historical fiction and memoir and literary fiction, in her free time she chooses to read a book that others would classify as chick lit, and she finds a lot of redeeming things in it. So I couldn't resist.
At its heart, the book is a testament and a tribute to women's friendships.
Definitely.
And it was that your inspiration for the book?
Oh, definitely. It absolutely was. And their relationship is so similar to mine with some of my closest girlfriends, and I'm still astounded every single time. It gets harder and harder as we get older and our lives get busier and they're changing, but I can still go out to dinner with any one of my closest, you know, two or three girlfriends, and we'll sit and 4 hours just evaporate. They vanish into nothing. The two of us haven't stopped talking the entire time. We're listening, and it's so cathartic and it's so wonderful. And despite husbands and families and peers and colleagues, like, there's nothing like a girlfriend.
Well, my final question that I have to ask, because I guess there's somebody out there that doesn't know, who is Harry Winston?
I'm sure there are, but Harry Winston is the jeweler that adorns all of the celebrities on the red carpet at the Oscars, and they have really fabulous, really kind of aspirational for all of us boutiques, jewelry stores all over the country, and they have just the most gorgeous, gorgeous diamonds one could ever imagine.
Well, Lauren, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Robin Fisher talking with author Lauren Weisberger about her latest novel, Chasing Harry Winston, a novel. Weisberger will be speaking at the main branch of the Louisville Free Public Library Thursday evening at 7 as part of the Authors at the Library series. For more information, visit our website, wfpl.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at wfpl.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.